Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Podcast, the New Books and Political Science Podcast specifically. And today I'm joined by David Carroll, who's going to talk to us about his new book with Cambridge Elements, which is a part of Cambridge University Press. And this new book is titled Red, Green, and Blue, The Partisan Divide on Environmental Issues. This is an interesting new series from Cambridge University Press, and I'm going to have David tell us a little bit about that. But first, I want to welcome David Carroll to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project, Red, Green, and Blue.
Hi, Lily. Thanks. It's great to be here. I came to this project in a kind of unusual way. I'm an associate professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, and a lot of my research has concerned political parties and interest groups. And I did a book several years ago called Party Position Change in American Politics, Coalition Management. And I wasn't planning actually to work on the environment or to do that much more about parties changing positions on issues. But I was actually asked to write a paper about that for a think tank here in the DC area called the Niskanen Center. It's very nice and flattering when some non-academic actually reads your academic research, you know, especially several years later. It's very encouraging, you know. The director of the center, Jerry Taylor, said, "Why didn't you talk about the environment in your book?" I said, "Well, you can't cover every case." He said, "Would you think about looking at how the environment has changed as a partisan issue and maybe with some view towards possible trends, future developments?" So I said, "Sure." And then after that, it was suggested that this could maybe work in an expanded format for this new Cambridge Elements series. And that's really how it came about. I've long been interested in how parties develop the platforms that they have, why the interest groups or societal groups that are aligned with the two parties are in the coalitions in which they find themselves, how that happens. I think it's a fascinating topic. And I've been interested in the environment like, I guess, any other person. But it wasn't a research focus. So I definitely come to this from the parties and interest group side and the political history side, not from the environmental studies, although I've tried to learn from people like that and to cite them.
And so I wanted to ask you a little bit, and this is what this very slim book, but, you know, really well composed and very detailed in lots of interesting ways. This book goes through, as you note in it, you're looking at the various ways that political actors, the parties, the interest groups have all coalesced and to some degree shifted here and there around questions of environmental policy, conservation, as you note, the name change. So could you tell us a little bit about the broad sort of scope of how you are both looking at these questions not just the partisan divide, but also the political history around conservation and environmentalism?
Yes, that's a good question. The modern environmentalism, as we know it, is a relatively recent issue compared to some other topics that are in the news. For example, tariffs are in the news because of President Trump. And, you know, tariffs as a source of political controversy go back to the revolution. The environmental issue is not that old. The earliest version of it in the early 20th century is the question of conservation. And you see debates around that in the early 20th century between Theodore Roosevelt and his supporters and William Howard Taft. But what they mean by conservation is not the same as modern environmentalism in a number of ways. They're concerned about natural resources. They're concerned about private interests abusing them. Very much still more believing that the issue is just scientific management in the public interest and that to maximize economic growth, less concern about environment in, let's say, a kind of mystical, aesthetic, metaphysical way. And of course, the conservation movement was tied in, as many progressive causes were, with a lot of other baggage that today people would find very repellent. I mean, with eugenics, with racism, it's not just that most people were racist in that time by our standards, but some of the leading conservationists wanted to conserve flora, fauna, and the best breed of people, so to speak. You find that with people like Madison Brown, who was the founder of the New York Zoological Society, savior of the redwood, savior of the bison, and super racist, you know, didn't want immigrants coming from Eastern and Southern Europe. They weren't white enough. So there's a big history of that. And then the part of conservation that becomes broadly accepted is there needs to be some management of natural resources in what's seen as the public interest by experts. But for a long time, there's really in the middle of the 20th century, no political controversy about this. It's just something everyone is sort of for on some level. And you see, and I show this in the book, it's barely mentioned in party platforms, just very token discussion or in the speeches of presidential nominees, which is another way to track party positioning. There are not a lot of controversies in Congress. Issues that today, looking back, we would say, oh, this is an environmental question, were processed in a very different way. So there was a big fight in the early 50s. In the Thailand's swampy area on the coastline of the United States and places like Louisiana, does this belong to the federal government or does this belong to the state government? But no one is saying, as they might today, hey, maybe you don't want to do so much offshore drilling in that ecologically fragile area. That wasn't part of the debate. And there were debates about should the government build and develop nuclear power or should that be done by private industry? And the same thing with big hydroelectric dams. But it was all processed through kind of the New Deal framework of, you know, big government versus private sector. That was the issue divide. It wasn't about the environment. And that modern environmental movement really arises in the 60s and 70s. And then that starts to change. The issue as we know it develops. The term environmentalism actually mostly supplants conservationism. You still hear that term, but it's used much less. And now it's used much more just for people focused on endangered species. In the past, it would have been used for people who are fighting the construction of a plant, a dam or something like that. So conservation was really a nonpartisan movement. That's another important point. It was a nonpartisan movement. It was a very elite movement. It was not a big mass following, and then there was just no controversy for a long time. And so you can see environmentalism is one of the new social issues that arises starting in the 60s and 70s, along with other issues like feminism, LGBT rights, rights for people with disabilities, and just a whole series of questions that in the mid 20th century were just not on the agenda.
And that's, I mean, you really set this up in such a really clear and smooth manner in the book, because you do go through this definition change and also the sort of different political actors who were involved. And the thrust of the book, and again, this is an interesting series, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about it, but I do want to get to the sort of thrust of the book, is really about this very careful study that you did in terms of coding words and the speeches that presidential nominees gave, the platforms themselves, and where you start to see the sort of what we consider the polarization setting in around environmentalism as it moves into more so the Democratic Party. Can you talk a little bit about the way that you set up the research and what you found as you were doing it?
Well, yeah, I think the challenge in studying American political parties, and this is a party story in the end, is that they are very amorphous. That, you know, other countries' parties have formal membership, and, you know, you can be expelled from a party. In the U.S., it's much harder to say where the parties begin and end. So if we want to say, if we want to look at the question of where the parties are in the environment and how that changed over time, we need to look at that from as many angles as possible. So as you mentioned, I look at candidate speeches, I look at party platforms. I also spend a lot of time looking at congressional votes on the environment, and not in the sense of doing a legislative history, how we got the Clean Air Act, how this or that bill was passed, but to look at the ratings from the League of Conservation Voters, and in other ways to just see how the parties are aligned. Because I said conservation was a nonpartisan movement. In the early days of environmentalism, of modern environmentalism, there still also was a lot of bipartisan support, and there was bipartisan opposition as well. And that today, for people looking at the issue, it's so associated with the Democratic Party. We see now the Democratic presidential candidates all have to come out with their climate plan. You know, Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency and signed the Endangered Species Act. I look also in terms of data at the behavior of interest groups. I look at their ratings. I look at their endorsements. And I use some archival research on the deliberations within the Sierra Club. And they were very hesitant to get into partisan politics. They were hesitant to get into electoral politics at all. And then they, as much as possible, wanted to avoid being associated with one party or the other. But the logic of the two-party system in the United States is very strong, and the dynamic is very powerful. And it's not easy for a group to avoid being sucked in. And they certainly have not.
And you talk about also the sort of development and growth of those groups themselves.
That's right. That's right. So I was kind of surprised when I went back to look. I learned some of this. The Sierra Club didn't really exist outside of California, where it's still based, although it has a Washington office, of course. It didn't really exist outside of California until the 1950s. And even then, it was mostly a West Coast organization. And other prominent environmental groups that we know today, the League of Conservation Voters, whose ratings I use so much in this study, they didn't exist until the end of the 1960s. And they were kind of a splinter. David Brower, who had been the executive director of the Sierra Club and was forced out, he created new organizations. He created the League of Conservation Voters and Friends of the Earth. And part of that was, I think, personality conflicts and some divisions within, environmental movement. We could talk about how it's changed. It's in beyond partisan terms. And, you know, one of the things was he was against nuclear. He came to be against nuclear power, which environmentalists weren't always, and which some of them are reconsidering now, and basically because of climate change. But in the 70s that became a prominent cause, environmentalism against nuclear power. And you don't see that in the Sierra Club in the 50s or the 60s. And there's a tremendous growth, though. The Sierra Club does become a national organization. It becomes much more prominent. The League of Conservation Voters, as I said, is founded and becomes active in campaigns from the beginning, from the 70s, before the Sierra Club is willing to do that. Friends of the Earth, there are other groups, more say militant groups like Greenpeace. So new groups have continued to be founded. But yeah, there's an explosion, and which is true, as I said, of groups in many of these issue areas that weren't on the agenda in the mid 20th century. All the rights revolution that's been called for all sorts of marginalized and disadvantaged groups. And I think environmentalism can be seen in some ways. I mean, it's complicated because the people who are active environmentalism usually are not marginalized people at all. But it's this activism, I think, coincides with all those other movements.
And you do a really careful study. You pull together, as you note, sort of the ratings from the various interest groups on how members of Congress are supporting legislation or not. And you also look at the speeches that candidates give, where the party platforms are. And so pulling all of that information together, what did you trace in terms of this understanding of the partisan divide? You know, the title of the book, The Partisan Divide on Environmental Issues. Then you start out saying in the 50s and 60s, this was not controversial, but it becomes more controversial.
Yeah. Well, first, there's really just no discussion of this topic or minimal. Then, except just conservation is just something people give lip service to. But when it becomes a controversy, it's still not a partisan controversy. And of course, it emerges at the time that we now look upon as the low point in terms of party polarization in modern American history. In the 1960s and the 1970s, this is a time when there's still many conservative Southern Democrats and moderate Republicans, especially from the Northeast, both almost extinct species today. In Congress, what I found was a couple of interesting things, one of which was a new thing that I think is interesting from the standpoint of the study of parties and representation that I didn't find in my previous book. So two major things. Well, three things. The main thing is the issue today is very partisan in Congress. That was not true when they started rating members of Congress around 1970, the League of Conservation Voters. It changed very gradually. It's a really an evolutionary story, not a revolutionary story. There's some key moments. Ronald Reagan, as on many other issues like abortion and gun control, he's important in kind of branding the Republican Party on one side of this issue, not the environmental side. But in Congress, it's quite gradual. And the two big things that I think that I noticed were initially members of Congress who are not voting. You say, well, if they're not voting on party lines, how do we understand their voting patterns? There are district interests. So people from rural areas, from agricultural areas, from areas that where mining is an important industry, they're less supportive of environmental causes. And in the early period, a lot of them are Democrats because, the realignment that we've gradually seen had yet to occur. So many people from, West Virginia was a very Democratic state, Kentucky, where mining is, where the oil industry in Texas and Louisiana is, and the rural areas generally, there were many more Democrats representing them. And over time, what we see now is, yes, there has been a realignment. And so those constituencies today, for a lot of other reasons besides the environmental issue, have generally Republican representatives and senators. But I also show that in the same constituency, because of the alignment of environmental interest groups with the Democratic Party and business interests that are in conflict with them, with the Republican Party, in the same constituency. So when you have some states that have a Democratic and a Republican senator, They differ. Those two senators do not vote the same way on the environment. And if we track those states with what are called mixed delegations, one Democratic and Republican senator, it's not the same states, but there are always several states in that category. And if we track just that population of senators, we see a great polarization, a growing divide between the parties on the environmental issue since the 70s, gradually. And so it's not just Democrats don't represent West Virginia in the South anymore. That's part of it. But even representing the same state or the same district, Democrat and Republican will vote differently on environmental issues. And the other thing that I found that really was interesting to me was in the early days of the issue in Congress, people who wrote about it in the 70s showed that the same characteristics that predicted support for the environment among ordinary people did so in Congress as well. So the constituency for environmentalism tends to be young and highly educated. And within Congress, the age variable and educational attainment were both predictive of members of Congress' position on the environment, controlling for their party, controlling for their composition of the workforce in their district, economic interests, controlling for pretty much everything else. And if we look at surveys today in the public, those factors are still important. Younger people, more highly educated people still are more concerned about the environment than others. But in Congress, that's much less true today. Those factors are much less predictive than they were because of the polarization. And that's something that, there's a lot of studies about how much do the personal characteristics of representatives matter, often looking at things like race and gender, but other factors like age and education may also matter. But what I show is that's really very contingent. And when the party pressures are strong because of the party interest group connections, those factors may play less of a role than they would have at a different point in time.
And I wanted to ask you another sort of question about one of the building blocks that you integrate to show some of what's going on in the United States and the particularities of the American sort of party system is you pull in a bit of a comparative perspective to look at environmentalism in other developed countries, particularly Western European ones. Can you talk a little bit about some of that comparative understanding and where the distinctions are?
Yes. I went to graduate school to be a comparativist and it didn't work out that way. I was going to be a Middle East scholar, but in a way it's a return to my roots. Yeah. Often people talk about American exceptionalism. And one thing that's distinctive about the United States is the strength of the two-party system. Even countries that have two major parties often have several significant minor parties. And we really don't. I mean, the Green Party in a very flukish election in 2000 was important, but other than that, not so much. And it's not really so much of an environmentally focused party anyway, as opposed to just a left-wing party. By comparison, many other countries, many other advanced, democratic, wealthy countries that maybe you could see as the peer group for the United States, they have green parties elected in their parliament or in their national legislature, holding seats. And in several cases, these parties have been part of coalition governments. And so they've controlled cabinet ministries. And the United States is unusual in that we don't have any green members of the House or the Senate. We don't have coalition governments in the same way either because we don't have a parliamentary system, but it's just unusual. So the way it's worked in the United States is that these movements that in countries with different electoral systems might create their own parties, they often get channeled into the two-party system. And my argument is basically the Republican Party, even before environmentalism came around, was the business party. And the alignment of groups with parties is often dependent on what other groups are doing. And so it's path dependent. organized labor came into the Democratic Party, which was really an agrarian party. I'm talking about in the New Deal period, had been mostly an agrarian party because the Republican Party was the business party even then. So they just had more, they didn't necessarily agree with farmers about everything, but they were in more direct conflict with the business interests. And a generation or two later, it's the same story for the environmental movement. There are certainly tensions sometimes between the environmentalists and labor. You see that the AFL-CIO is not yet on board with the Green New Deal plan, but there's much more direct and consistent conflict with business interests, with the oil and gas, coal industry, forestry, the auto industry, where it concerned emission standards. And so it was just easier for Democratic politicians, I think, to reach out to environmentalists than for Republicans to do so over time.
And so I also wanted to ask you a little bit about the series that this book is published in. It's called Cambridge Elements, American Politics. And the series is edited by Francis Lee. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this series, because it's not, this is not a full length book, right? But it's a very good brief book. And I wanted to know a little bit more about this Cambridge Elements series.
Sure. So I would say maybe more of a novella than a novel, if you want to say it like that. It's about 30,000 words. It's a paperback. There is not a hardcover version. It's also part of the Cambridge Core digital series, which universities' libraries subscribe to. So the idea behind the Cambridge Elements, this is part of the Cambridge series, Elements in American Politics, but there are several other element series in political science and in other disciplines, is that there was a need that was felt for a kind of format that was somewhere in between the conventional article, which is getting often more and more brief and more narrow. And what is necessary to get into a journal, often now it has to be very narrowly focused on a test of causality in political science, maybe different in other disciplines, that just doesn't encompass all the kinds of studies of important phenomena that we need. But not everything needs to be a 300-page tome either. And so there ought to be something in between. So as you mentioned in this study, there is historical scope, whether I'm talking about the voting patterns in Congress or the alignment of the parties that you can see in platforms or presidential candidate speeches or the development of environmentalism away from the kind of racist conservationist movement and to this kind of more woke version that we have today. That's something that takes many decades, and it's hard to do that in an article. But it's a single case. I'm adding to a literature about parties and interest groups. I'm adding some, broader points that are new, like about how the members. Personal characteristics matter only in certain circumstances. I think that's a broader interest. But the idea of the elements is that you should be able to approach a topic like this within, a reasonable length. And I think it's readable and it's approachable for students, for undergrads, as well as for graduate students. So that's the idea of it. And I really hope I'm honored to be part of it. I think I'm the fifth one in the American Politics series, and I really hope that it continues. It's peer-reviewed, the Cambridge University Press, my previous book, which was also with Cambridge, which was considerably longer. So the basically the process was the same. The differences for the author are that it comes out more quickly. It comes out only several months after it's finally accepted instead of a year. And wow, that's great, because as academic writing, by the time it's accepted and then it's revised and but it comes out, you're on to the next thing, and it's so long ago since you wrote it. That's what, it's so different from the, now ever at Twitter with instant reaction. So the elements to me is a very promising development in academic publishing that I think is good for teaching, and I think it's good for research. You should be able to make a contribution that doesn't necessarily fit neatly in a 10,000 word article, but that doesn't need to be a massive volume that takes years and years. So that's the hope anyway.
Well, I think this is a really nice asset, and I personally can see using this in my public policy class, because I think it's a really good sort of précis on understanding environmentalism as a policy and in a partisan context. So since you did mention other projects, I'd love, David, for you to tell me a little bit about what you're working on now.
Okay, so I am working on one of those massive tomes. For a long time, I've been really interested in elite opinion, and I was really interested in issue areas. I mean, I always come to politics through looking at issues and patterns, and I found there's some issues on which there wasn't a partisan division as much as the president was in conflict with the Congress, regardless of which party controlled which branch of government. And I started looking at that with trade policy, my first article many years ago. And I got interested in that as a broader phenomenon. And I came to the view, which is not what the literature says, that for the most part, for some structural reasons, the president reflects elite opinion when there's a dominant view among elites. There isn't always. And elites aren't always at odds with the public, but sometimes they are. Or they're at odds with an important interest group. And then I think the president is going to be more likely to represent them than Congress is, unless that interest group is central to his party coalition. The interesting thing about this is I had this idea for quite a while, and then Donald Trump pops up.
Course.
And Donald Trump, is a challenge to pretty much all of political science. Yes. Was a co-author of The Party Decides, and certainly the party did not decide on Donald Trump. has to be acknowledged. They may decide on some other people. And I thought, wow, he's going to ruin both books. But no, he's, I think, an interesting exception that proves the rule, because he was definitely not socialized into elite opinion. We know he's not a big reader. And so he kind of shows, I think, that this behavior by the president is not automatic, because he certainly does not reflect dominant elite views on many issues. But it's based on the premise that the president and his close advisors will reflect those views. And I think that's a sound generalization, but all generalizations can meet exceptions, and he is one. So I think that makes it kind of even more interesting and more timely book project.
Well, when you finish that project, will you come back on the New Books podcast and talk to me about it?
Absolutely. That would be great.
So I want to thank you, David Carroll, with a K, for joining me today to talk about Red, Green, and Blue, The Partisan Divide on Environmental Issues. And this is published by Cambridge University Press, specifically Cambridge Elements in American Politics. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.